the New Books and Political Science podcast. My name is Heath Brown. Today I'll be talking with the author of Subsidizing Democracy, How Public Funding Changes Election Work in the Future. The book is published by Cornell University Press. The author is Michael Miller. I have the real pleasure to talk with Michael today. I hope that you enjoy. Welcome back to the podcast. Again, I'm speaking with Michael Miller today, who's the author of Subsidizing Democracy, How Public Funding Changes Elections and How It Can Work in the Future, published by Cornell University Press. Michael, how are you doing today?
I'm well. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, pleasure to have you on. You are based in New York City, as I am. Maybe you can tell us just a little bit about yourself, where you are now, where you've been in the past.
Sure. I'm an assistant professor of political science at Barnard College in New York right now. This was my first year. And for 4 years before that, I was at the Springfield campus at the University of Illinois, which was my first job out of grad school. And before grad school, I was a political operative doing strategy and consulting on federal political campaigns, which really gave me the questions and ideas that I pursued in the dissertation that ultimately became this book.
Yeah, and it's you know, not surprising that you say this, given the details of this book. And I can't think of a book that is more timely right now than yours. You know, the coverage of the role of money in politics in the 2016 election seems to just grow and grow and grow every day. You allude to it just now, but when did this book project begin?
I remember the exact moment, actually. I had been working on a U.S. House race. I was actually the campaign manager on that race. And one of the things that the media get right, they get an awful lot wrong about, you know, when you see dramatic accounts of political campaigns, they get most of it wrong most of the time. But one thing that they always get right is that moment where you make the concession call, right? Your candidate has lost and you're in this dark hotel room and everybody feels really defeated and you call the congressman and concede. And my candidate did that and he hung up the phone and looked at me and said, imagine what we could have done if only we'd been able to raise money. And, you know, that was a problem that dogged that candidate. And that's the dirty secret of American politics, I think. If you really looked into congressional campaigns, state legislative campaigns, and just see how many of them are not what we think they are, that campaign was not at all atypical. It was run out of the candidate's house. We didn't really have a proper office for much of it. And we were outspent, I think, 8-1 in that race. And you just see these candidates, you know, you can make a market argument and say, well, one reason you're so underfunded is because, you know, you're in a district where people don't think you're going to win, or you're just not a very good candidate to begin with. And I think there's merit to that. But from the perspective of the candidates who, you know, are possibly there knowing that they're going to lose, they do feel cheated, figuring that, you know, at the very least, voters deserve a choice and a conversation. And I think in that moment, I started thinking about, well, are there reforms that could have delivered the conversation to voters in this district? Is there a way for a candidate like this, even if he's probably not going to win, to, you know, at least circumvent the market forces that really silenced him during that race? And I started looking into the various programs in the states, and I discovered these ones and really thought that the way that they were being written about did not reflect the way that candidates would set their strategy and orient to them and respond to the incentives that they offered. And that's really where I went in the book.
Yeah. And, you know, the larger context of this story that you tell is the rising cost of running for office. You suggest a couple of the answers to this question, but what is the harm of expensive campaigns? Why is this something that we should all think about and maybe worry about?
Well, you know, I don't know if there is an inherent harm in expensive campaigns. I mean, the Supreme Court has consistently held that, you know, the more money in politics, the better, because it means more speech and more perspectives. And I'm sensitive to that. But from the perspective of candidates, and particularly would-be candidates, you know, imagine you're a school teacher and you want to run for state house or even Congress. And the one thing that's really going to keep you from doing that is the cost of running. You look at the price tag in some states, you know, it's $50,000-$70,000 just to win a seat in the lower house of the legislature. And people are really going to struggle with that. I mean, who out there can raise that kind of money with their existing network of friends and professional connections? And so it's problematic from a democratic theory standpoint if you believe that running for office is the penultimate form of participation. I think by raising these financial barriers, we are really dealing people out and leaving, the ramifications for that are that, you know, serving as a legislator are really, you know, it really becomes the service, a place for the rich, and you keep, so-called average folks out of office. And I'm not sure that that's the intent.
Now, you focus on public financing of elections. I wonder if you'd map for us where public financing is available and also the variation in what's available to candidates in these different places.
Sure. There's a lot of flavors of public financing. And I think, you know, for listeners, it's really important to clarify that we are not talking about congressional campaigns in the book. There's no public funding available for congressional candidates in the U.S. There is for presidential candidates, but it's been, you know, largely that system has fallen away now as elections have exploded in cost recently. So we're talking about elections for state offices, and the programs that I engaged in the book are called Clean Election Systems, and they were active in 2008, which was the election that I examined in Arizona, Connecticut, and Maine, and there were smaller partial programs in Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Hawaii. And those are the programs that I took on in the book. The difference between clean elections and partial funding is fairly straightforward. As a clean elections candidate in, say, Arizona, if I want to run for the state House of Representatives in Arizona, what I need to do is convince 210 people to give me exactly $5. And if I can do that, the state deems me a viable candidate and gives me essentially all of the money that I need to run a viable campaign for that office, which is at the time was a little more than $30,000. So once you and the way that you demonstrate viability is, you know, it varies by state, but that's really the nature of this thing. You get these small $5 contributions from a preset number of people, and then you get all of the money that you need. And so the deal that you make with the state in these programs is you're only going to spend that money. So if I get $33,000, I'm not going to go out and raise any more. I've agreed to a firm spending cap. So really what those programs do is they take fundraising off of the menu of things that candidates need to do. So in contrast, the smaller systems in Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Hawaii, they only give you a little bit of the money. So you might have a $30,000 spending limit, but they'll only give you $8,000. The rest you have to raise yourself. And I recognized strategically those two kinds of programs created a vastly different incentives for candidates.
Now, are these mandatory? Do we see students or candidates opting into these? And do we have races where there is a candidate who has opted in and another where the other candidate hasn't opted in? How do these work in practice?
Yeah, that's a great question. Public funding, anytime it includes a spending cap, which it almost always does, public funding has to be optional because the Supreme Court held in the Buckley decision that spending is speech. So if you're you can't mandate a spending cap on a candidate. So you see these candidates will have the choice of whether they want to opt in or opt out. And what that really comes down to is a calculated decision. Can I raise more money than the spending limit? And what would the effort be to have to do that? Now, at the time I wrote the book, there was also this kind of curious feature of the clean election systems called matching funds, where if I run against you and I take the public money and you don't, because maybe you're an incumbent and you figure, well, I can raise much more than $33,000 pretty easily. I can raise $75,000. So you opt out and you raise money in the private marketplace, just like any candidate that we might think of would do. For every dollar that you would spend above my $33,000, I would get a check to match, and we would be locked in financial parity up to about $100,000. So you would have to work actually really hard to outspend me. And this kind of created other, you know, incentives for candidates. In this situation, you might rationally figure that, hey, you know, I want to do all these things, but I've already spent more than Miller's $33,000, so I'm not going to do that because, you know, as one candidate in the book says, that feeds the alligator trying to eat me. And so, you know, that actually became the basis of a First Amendment challenge that candidates brought after I wrote the book about that part of public funding. And the Supreme Court ultimately struck that down as an unconstitutional restriction on First Amendment rights of non-participating candidates. So there's all kinds of things happening here by the structure of the program.
Now, one of the hopes of public funding is to allow candidates to campaign rather than just fundraise. What did you find about the effects of public funding on just the daily life of candidates for office?
Well, I began the book with the, you know, kind of theoretical expectation that, hey, it's not just about money. Sure, money's great. If you have it as a candidate, you can use it to buy the ads, buy the mailers that you're going to use to change people's mind, get your word out. But really, I mean, from my experience running congressional campaigns, I know that candidates are spending 6, 7, 8 hours a day raising money. And what I found for state legislative candidates, you know, I should say that I surveyed candidates for the book in the 2008 election, not just the 6 states that I mentioned. I actually surveyed candidates from 18 states because I wanted to get good comparison of privately and publicly funded candidates. And what I found that candidates running for state house that are raising money from private sources are spending about 6 hours a week just on fundraising. And so the expectation was, you know, as a campaign manager or as a candidate, what could I do with 6 hours a week? And I expected that the candidates weren't going to, you know, go to the beach and take a day off with that time, but rather that they'd reinvested into things that political science has previously demonstrated to be really effective at, you know, getting out supporters, like high quality face-to-face field canvassing. And that's what I found. There's about 5 percentage points difference in the personal interaction between candidates and voters when the candidates are taking public funding. And that translates to gains in votes. In districts where at least one candidate was publicly funded, we see much higher voter participation to the tune of about 20% more people are voting. That's, you know, for people who are nerdy like me, that would be a reduction in roll-off of about four percentage points. That's the percentage of people who, say, show up and vote for Obama and then leave. We see more people, because the theoretical expectation is not that, you know, these state legislative campaigns are going to be the reason why you get off the couch and go to the polling place. But maybe you hang around and keep voting farther down the ballot if somebody knocked on your door and said, hey, I'm running for office. And, you know, I think that story really hangs together as a narrative where, you know, because they don't have to raise money, they're getting out there and beating the bushes and knocking on doors and having conversations, as I say in the book, probably over the course of a campaign, thousands of conversations with voters that wouldn't have occurred otherwise. And, you know, going back to your earlier question about, you know, the concerns that we have for high price tag races, well, there it is. If you don't have to raise money, and it goes back to the question that the candidate asked me in that dark hotel room, imagine what we could have done if only we'd have the money. That's what they do.
And what about who actually runs? What did you find on the relationship between these public financing changes and anything about the quality of candidates?
Yeah, quality is a really tricky concept. And I think listeners to this podcast probably know that. You know, we have always defined it as a field as, well, we're going to put a variable in our models and call a candidate quality if they've won a lower office. And the recognition and the reason that we do that is because you think, well, if you've won a lower office, you've demonstrated the ability to run a viable campaign. And it's, you know, it's a shortcut measure of all the squishy things that we can't observe. What I find in the book is that, you know, when you give candidates normal people, you know, the school teacher that I was alluding to earlier, when you give them these large subsidies, they instantly demonstrate all the behavior that you'd expect from a quality candidate. I mean, they have the money to stand in there and go toe-to-toe in an advertising campaign. They have the money to pay the walkers. And so the campaign really isn't about who they knew before. It's about the connections that they make during the race. And one of the arguments that I make in the book is that these public subsidies really are an engine to manufacture instantly high-quality candidates. It's the one analogy that I've made a lot is it's like one of those, if you go camping, they have tents now that you can just kind of arrive and kind of throw it in the air and it pops up immediately. And, you know, that's what we're doing for candidate quality when we offer them these large subsidies. They're instant quality candidates.
Right. Now, from a certain standpoint, and maybe we just sort of step back from what you, I think, demonstrate in such interesting empirical ways in the book, is just a question of how much this actually matters. You know, as we look ahead to 2016, and you look at the funding, the direct funding from candidates, it's going to be tiny compared to the outside funding from super PACs and the like. Maybe you could just sort of talk about the larger context of how this matters in a turbocharged campaign system that has money coming in from so many different sides that developing a policy in one area is likely to be frustrated by all of this work in other areas. Can you talk a little bit about super PACs and how this relates?
Oh, sure. We've been wrestling with this idea for a long time. I mean, it's generally referred to as hydraulic theory, right? Like money is like water and it's going to find its way into the system, just like water finds its way into your basement if you have a crack. I think since I've written this book, which was done during the 2008 election, you know, we had Citizens United. We've seen an explosion of outside spending, not just in federal races, but also in the states. In fact, I think, you know, in 2016, we're really in for a huge explosion of outside money at the state level. But I think, you know, when we talk about this as scholars and when I, you know, have these conversations with folks in the reform community, I think you got to draw the line somewhere and say, okay, well, you know, maybe we give the candidate $30,000 and they do all these things and they run this really snappy, nice, publicly focused campaign, but you've got this super PAC who buries them in cash. And so why bother? But I don't know as a citizen that I can go along with that, because I think it's worth taking a step back and saying, are there policy things that we can do that at least give tools to people who want to participate in the process? And sure, you might get buried in outside spending, but you might not. And I think, you know, looking at the effects of campaign finance in determining who wins races, I think it's a little short-sighted to say, well, why bother doing this because there's all this money floating around? Because this one thing that I know is that money doesn't determine the winner of an election. You know, we see it every year. Challengers are outspent by incumbents, but they still knock them off. And so that's one thing to bear in mind. I think, you know, the one thing that we can say about money in politics is, you know, it might not determine the winner, but if you don't have any of it, you're not going to win. And these programs really address that concern. Why not give people the tools, even if they're going to lose? Why not give them the tools to give voters a real choice and have that conversation is the position that advocates of these programs, I think, would take.
Book is so interesting. I learned a lot from it. Both in terms of how to think about this upcoming election, but also just kind of confirming some things that you have a gut reaction about. But the way in which you document this with the empirical analysis is really interesting. Michael's book is Subsidizing Democracy, How Public Funding Changes Elections and How It Can Work in the Future, published by Cornell University Press. Michael, thank you very much for your time today.
Thanks for having me. It was fun.